The next case this morning is number 520-0045, People v. Shantz. Arguing for the appellant, Patricia Shantz, is Nathan Swanson. Arguing for the appellee, People of the State of Illinois, is Trent Marshall. Each side will have 10 minutes for their argument. The appellant will also have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Please note only the clerk is permitted to record these proceedings.
Good morning, gentlemen. Are you prepared to proceed?
Yes, sir. Good morning.
Mr. Swanson, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel. Appellant Patricia Shantz was convicted following a stipulated bench trial of one count of aggravated driving under the influence, resulting in a death, and one count of reckless homicide involving a motor vehicle. Following her conviction, the lesser offense of reckless homicide involving a motor vehicle was merged under the One Act, One Crime doctrine with the aggravated driving under the influence charge and vacated. Appellant challenges on appeal the trial court's denial of her motion to suppress the results of her blood draws. Jumping ahead slightly, with regards to the second blood draw, the argument is simply that because of the failure to properly provide her with the written tickets, that blood draw is inadmissible. The bulk of the argument, however, revolves around the circumstances of the first blood draw. The initial question with regard to the first blood draw is, because it's really not at all debatable that a blood draw is a governmental search and therefore implicates the Fourth Amendment, is under what authority did that first blood draw occur? It was not a consensual blood draw. The evidence was inarguable that Ms. Shantz was directed that they would be drawing her blood, and she submitted to that directive. It was not pursuant to a search warrant. That search warrant was not acquired until after the first blood draw and did not apply to it. And because the officer did not read her the warning to motorist, it was not pursuant to the Illinois implied consent law. The only other basis advanced for the lawfulness of the first blood draw was under section 11-501.2c2. Which holds that when a person is under arrest for probable cause for driving under the influence resulting and there's been an accident resulting in injury or death, the officer shall request and the driver shall provide blood sample. I would point out, as noted in People v. Eubanks, which is cited in the briefs, in footnote one of that, a bit of legislative history. Prior to 2011, that statute read slightly differently. It simply read that regardless of one's ability to refuse under the rest of the implied consent statute, that the driver shall provide a sample. In the middle of the statute in 2011, the legislature amended it to say, regardless of the ability to withdraw their consent or refuse, the officer shall request and the person shall provide a blood draw. This would indicate there's a clear legislative mandate that the officer can't simply say, go do a blood draw. They have to make the request. The case law is also clear that if there is a refusal, even though the statute mandates compliance, the officer cannot forcibly initiate the blood draw.
Is it forcibly or physically forcibly?
Physically forcibly, Your Honor. So physically restrain and remove it against resistance, which that's not an issue here. I think the pertinent point of that addition, though, is the officer had to make a request. And I think the record is clear here that prior to the first blood draw, there was never a request made.
Well, wait a minute now. We are, I think, presuming that the nurse who took the draw was acting as an agent and instrumentality of law enforcement. That's correct?
Yes, Your Honor. I think that's, we are presuming that, but I also think the record bears that out. The testimony.
She came into the room where the defendant was seated. There was no police officer there. I think there was a police officer outside the door, but the nurse came in and said, I came in to basically take your blood. Is there any way you could interpret this as a request by an agent of law enforcement?
I think under the totality of the circumstances, you couldn't arrive at that conclusion, Your Honor. My recollection of the record is that law enforcement transported Ms. Shantz to the hospital, told her we are going for to take your blood. They arrived there. The officer escorted Ms. Shantz into the hospital, told the nurses, I'm going to need a blood draw, left the hospital to get some paperwork, including the implied warning to motorists. And during his absence from the hospital, I'm not sure if he was outside the door or outside the hospital, but while he was gone, that's when the nurse came in and did the blood draw. I think under those facts, I don't think there's really any argument that this was a private blood draw, but for the officer bringing Ms. Shantz there and telling the nurse that he was going to need a blood draw, this wouldn't have occurred.
Okay, what about the fact that the drug draw was obviously in excess of the direction of the officer? Suppose the officer said, well, you know, don't do it now. I'm going back to get my paperwork. And then the agent, in violation of the direction, proceeded to take the blood draw. Does that matter, since there's really no allegation of improper conduct on the part of the officer?
Well, I don't think that would make a difference under this circumstance, just because the ultimate issue that I don't think there's really an argument about is, but for the officer's direction, it wouldn't have occurred. Mm-hmm. You know, that had the nurse waited, we'd be in a different counterfactual world, but we don't know what that world would look like. We don't know if the officer would have read the warning to motorist or not, or what would have happened under those circumstances. But we do know that the nurse was acting on the basis of the officer's statement, I'm going to need a blood draw. Or we can at least conclude that beyond any cavil. The issue here is essentially, does 11501.1c2 basically function as a standalone authorization for, in any circumstance, the officers can direct a blood draw without a request, without a search warrant, without any exigency, and get one? And the problem with that interpretation of 501.1c2 is that is precisely what the Supreme Court said in People v. Eubanks would not be appropriate. That in Eubanks, the Supreme Court held that 501.1c2 was a codified exigency that pursuant to Schmerber and Missouri versus McNeely and the subsequent cases, Mitchell. But it did note that it's not that broad. It doesn't apply to all of those circumstances. This essentially is a circumstance, you know, to look at that particular event, this is that circumstance that in Eubanks, the Supreme Court said, that would not be okay. Once the blood draw was completed, the officer did read the implied consent, requested a blood draw, that was denied. At that point, he went and got a search warrant. Had the officer, after having properly read the implied consent, and I would also point out the case law is clear that 501.1c2 has been interpreted as part and parcel of the entire 501 series, the entirety of the implied consent and driving under the influence. We don't read it by itself. We read it as part of that whole body of law. So had he requested one at that point, had he made the request then, she denied it. He could have ordered a blood draw then, but again, that's not what happened. He then went and got a search warrant. As the state correctly notes, in their response brief, the question is now, was there an exigency present beyond just the normal codified exigency of the statute? And I think the facts are that there was not. The accident occurred around 7 o'clock. The first blood draw occurs at 7:50. The implied consent is read and denied at 8:30. And within 2.5 hours, a search warrant has been obtained and the second blood draw has occurred. There's no exigency in effects here that would have precluded the request for a warrant. What it boils down to is that very first blood draw doesn't happen under the aegis of any exigency, it doesn't happen in the search warrant, and doesn't happen under the implied consent or following the procedures thereof as required by the legislature. So the trial court erred in denying the motion to suppress on that point. The ultimate effect of this is such that Ms. Jantz's convictions should be overturned. The stipulated bench trial was based in large, she was found guilty of the driving while intoxicated and the reckless. Both of those were charged, at least in part, based on her intoxication. without the first blood draw, the retrograde extrapolation, even if you assume the second blood draw is admissible, the retrograde extrapolation of what her blood alcohol content would have been at the time of the accident, that wouldn't have been possible and it wouldn't have been admissible. And without that fact, the conviction can't stand. And if there aren't any questions, and I'm right at my time.
Any questions, Justice Moore?
Well, let's assume that you're right as to the first blood draw. You're not contesting the search warrant, are you?
No, sir.
And what about the evidence remaining, even if you throw out the first blood draw?
Well,
is that enough to sustain the conviction?
And we would argue that is not, Your Honor, that especially considering that a substantial portion of the state's evidence was that retrograde extrapolation, that because the first blood draw revealed a 0.15 and the second blood draw revealed a 0.78, then the assumption would be that her blood alcohol at the time of the accident was higher than the 0.15 because it would have been decreasing. That without that, whether or not she was under the influence above the legal limit or otherwise would not be established beyond a reasonable doubt.
Thank you, Justice Welch.
No questions.
Any further questions, Justice Moore?
So what was the second draw sample result?
My recollection is, without checking my notes, was that the second blood draw revealed a 0.078.
And that's only two one-hundredths off of the legal threshold?
Yes, sir.
And that was how many hours later?
That blood draw occurred at 11, so around 3.
Okay, thank you.
Also, the technician indicated that there was a plus or minus error that might have brought it up to 0.08. Is that correct?
That is true, Your Honor, although the plus or minus error also might have brought it below. And the other pertinent point is with regard to the retrograde extrapolation is that without the first blood draw, whether or not her blood alcohol was rising or falling, and therefore what her blood alcohol would have been at the time of driving, couldn't be established. With a single data point, we don't know where it would have been 3 hours beforehand. With the two data points, they can make an extrapolation thereof.
Okay, any other questions?
No questions.
Mr. No. Marshall, in all fairness, I'm going to give you 3 additional minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor.
You may proceed.
Thank you, sir. State would first note that the defendant's arguments regarding the applicability of Eubanks are raised for the first time in his reply brief. So to the extent that this court would deem it appropriate, state would ask that those arguments be found waived pursuant to Supreme Court Rule 341H7. That said, the state's primary position with respect to the first blood draw is that between Jones, Harrison, and Eubanks, C2 has always been constitutional, facially constitutional when applied in cases involving death or serious injury. In April 2016, Trooper Scruggs could have reasonably relied on Jones and Harrison, and Eubanks later confirmed that that reliance was sound. A fair reading of Eubanks and state's reading of it is that the police can, as a matter of course, always rely on Section C2 in cases involving death or serious injury, so long as they don't do so lazily, or so long as the facts demonstrate that they acted with the expected urgency under the circumstances. Defendant suggests in his reply brief that nothing suggests that a warrant could not have been obtained, but I don't believe that that's the proper focus. It's not what the police could have hypothetically have done. It's how they actually proceeded and used their time. And if they use their time in a manner that undermines the very purpose of C2, then they can't rely on it. And these facts are nothing like the facts in Eubanks. These facts, I submit, present the exact kind of scenario that Eubanks indicated allows for reasonable reliance on C2. Now, as for Justice Wharton had picked up on this, as for the defendant's argument that there had to be a specific request before C2 is triggered, I'm not sure that's the case. And if it was, the state would argue that the nurse who was present was acting as an agent. And although she directed it, instead of saying, may I please have your blood, it was still a circumstance that fell under C2 if it was required. Now, with respect to the second blood draw, even if the first one should have been suppressed, the warrant was supported by probable cause. It revealed 0.078 6 hours after the crash. On page 14 of the state's brief, represented that those results were extrapolated to reveal the BAC was 0.188 at the time of the crash. Defendant's reply brief, she maintains that the first draw was the basis for the extrapolation. My reading of page C-169 of the record, which is a relevant portion, I'd submit that both statements are accurate. It appears that both were used in the extrapolation data to obtain this extrapolation data. I'm not sure if one was dependent on the other or if they could have been independently obtained. To the extent that that is an ambiguity, the state would ask it to be resolved against the appellant. And on that, I would add that even assuming that the extrapolation evidence was based solely on the first draw, and that the only evidence that was properly garnered from the second was that she had a BAC of 0.078 6 hours after, the trial court still could have properly considered that as additional evidence of impairment pursuant to 511.501.2b2. I acknowledge that I cite that's not in the brief, in the state's brief, but I did not realize, or I didn't catch that possible ambiguity with respect to the retrograde extrapolation until I read Mr. Swanson's reply brief. State's final point, I guess, would be that even assuming the trial court should not have considered any of the BAC evidence from either draw, the remaining evidence indicating that defendant was under the influence of alcohol at the time of the crash, summarized at the state's brief on pages 15 and 16, was sufficient to support the trial court's finding of guilt. And if there are any questions, I would just respectfully request that the trial court's judgment be affirmed.
I have a question. Okay, yes, it was clear in Eubanks where the law enforcement officers waited so long until, I think, the blood alcohol content was zero, and the court found that the failure to act expeditiously indicated that there was no exigent circumstances. Are you saying that if the officers act expeditiously, that is an indication of exigent circumstances, or that's conclusive, if I could ask you that way?
I think Eubanks can fairly be read as holding that, sir, yes. Because in Eubanks, it was almost like, well, first of all, they arrested him. They waited hours and hours, I think, before they interviewed him. They might have smelled alcohol. I think the evidence was he took a nap in between. They came back later, asked him to do a draw. He refused. And then they brought him to the hospital and got one forcibly. And then they were coming back later saying, we should be able to rely on C2. Given the accident circumstances presented by a wreck and the dissipation of BAC, and the court was like, it was disingenuous, because they're like, you didn't act with any exigency at all with that. You waited and waited. We're not going to allow you to rely on the statute.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And I would note, I checked last night, the relevant head note from Eubanks 11, and no subsequent treatment since then. But I feel fairly confident in the state's recitation that as long as the police act with the expected urgency under the circumstances, then they can reasonably rely on the statute.
Thank you. Justice Moore?
No questions.
Justice Welch?
No questions.
Mr. Swanson?
Thank you, Your Honor. Very briefly, with regards to the extrapolation, I would actually agree with the state. I think it's, and if I implied that the retrograde extrapolation was based solely on the first blood draw, then that was not my intention. My reading of it is that the retrograde extrapolation was based on both blood draws, which would suggest that if one of them was not present, the retrograde extrapolation couldn't have been achieved. That you need both data points. You need the first blood draw giving a result that's early, the second blood draw given a result later. And from that, you can plot it out on the graph and figure out what the BAC was. So without one, you can't do the plot. The line might go up, the line might go down, and you don't know.
What's the basis for that argument? Why can't you?
That is my understanding, and I should say that's my understanding of retrograde extrapolation and what that means. But I don't have the citation right in front of me, Your Honor, so I apologize. With regards to Eubanks, I guess the difference I would have with the state is that in Eubanks, and I'll quote it briefly, it's the Supreme Court said that, or that if you read 11501c2 in isolation, it would suggest that a warrant is unnecessary in all cases in which the police have a probable cause to believe a person has driven or been in actual physical control of a vehicle under the influence of drugs or alcohol and has caused a death or injury. However, under the United States Supreme Court case law, the general rule will not apply in those unusual cases in which the blood draw is solely for law enforcement purposes and the police could not reasonably judge that a warrant application would interfere with other pressing needs or duties. So we may differ about, you know, I understand that in Eubanks kind of the circumstances of that was they were dilly-dallying and going along. But in this case, the officers had no basis to conclude that they couldn't have gotten a warrant. So under that basis, I would argue that Eubanks, that unusual case situation, that would apply here. The officers were able to secure a warrant. They immediately did so once the issue came up. And without any other questions, I yield the rest of my time.
Justice Moore?
No other questions.
Justice Welch?
No more.
Thank you, gentlemen. We'll take this on advisement and the decision will be following.